Okay, we're back.
Yes.
Here we go again.
All right.
Start with music?
We should get music.
Let's do it.
Ready to music? All right. God, there's a lot of albums.
Oh, God.
Because I think a lot of stuff that should have come out in September probably got pushed to October.
I listened to 4.
That's a lot. That's a lot of records to listen to.
That's a personal best.
What do you want to talk about?
No, let's go through the list.
Yeah. Okay, so kind of 3 big pop albums came out. Bigger for the world than for America, I feel like. These were not huge artists here. But Kylie Minogue released Fever, an album that's going to sell 6 million copies globally. And it has that big single, Can't Get You Out of My Head. Big album. She's an Australian pop star. So it's a lot of Euro pop, a lot of fun house songs on it. I kind of like the album as a whole. Not bad, but also at the same time, it's very dated for an early 2000s Euro pop record. And this is also coming off of her having just made a record that was in sync with the Olympics, I think, that we talked about from like a year ago. So, I don't know. It is what it is. Like, also pretty tight runtime of 45 minutes. So, doing okay there. Get this. Michael Jackson would release his 10th and final album. 10th and final studio album called Invincible. It's an interesting album just because, you know, after he makes this record, he doesn't tour on it, and he doesn't do any promotion for it. So this is kind of it for MJ. Like, he'll still do, I think, a Super Bowl appearance, and he'll still tour other material. But I feel like, you know, if you were to go back into the 80s and into the 90s, like, a Michael Jackson album was an event. It was a big thing. Everybody, because he's the king of pop, right? He's the king of pop. So kind of just there, a little disappointing. He made it with a guy named Rodney Jerkins, who was a big producer from, I want to say from Miami, but yeah, he's produced tons and tons of R&B. And this album is actually, if you gave it a listen, there are some songs that almost feel like dubstep, like a kind of like a proto dubstep. A very interesting production style to it. And it's actually genuinely got some good songs. The title track, Invincible, there's one called Unbreakable, Heartbreaker. I like them all. Only big complaint, it's 77 minutes long. This thing used up every inch of space it could. So, I don't know. It still managed to sell 8 million copies. I don't know why Michael, this is a huge disappointment. Selling 8 million copies is unbelievable. It's just that Michael Jackson is such a big phenom from around the world that I guess he's getting those sales up. Because, I mean, I even after listening through it, I don't remember any of these songs being hits on the radio at the time. Some big hits on the radio came from Enrique Iglesias. He released his 2nd English language album, which I believe was his 5th of all of his records, because he is from Spain, Spanish. And yeah, the album's called Escape. So also sold 8 million copies worldwide. He's got a really big reach if you think about it, because he's hitting like all of these markets, both in the U.S. and in South America and over in Europe. So big, big sales. He had the song Escape and Heroes. Pretty tight runtime too, only like 40 minutes long. And the last 3 tracks, he records them in Spanish. Like, they're songs from earlier in the record, but this time they're Spanish. So that's out there too. Qualitatively, it's a fun record. I actually really like his voice. He's got a good voice. Enrique Iglesias is a very, listenable pop star. Doesn't really get too, like, kind of like R&B slimy with his music. It's just really enjoyable, very positive music. I like it. A band called The National. They're from Ohio. They released their self-titled record. They're an indie rock band, noted for having this singer with a very baritone voice. Like, they're going to have some really, really big records in the mid-2000s. Like, album of the year contender, kind of, within the indie scene. This record on its own, it's nothing. It's really nothing special. Again, it's think of it as, like, if Nick Cave made some indie rock kind of stuff. Kind of forgettable. I mean, not Nick Cave, of course, but some guy that sounds like Nick Cave.
For some reason, I thought you said Nick Cage. I was like, what the fuck?
No.
It's like if Nick Cage also made some music.
Well, Nicolas Cage is obsessed with Elvis.
Oh, is he?
So, yeah, he's a big Elvis guy. So I'm sure somewhere he's probably, you know, in the shower singing karaoke to Elvis tunes.
We can only hope.
Yeah. An album I really do love, even if it's not notable, really. Dismemberment Plan released an album called Change. I believe it's their 3rd album. They're from D.C., It's a post-punk band with a more of an indie sensibility to them. I just absolutely love this record. It is beautiful. I think if you go back and listen to their earlier records, there's kind of a jank to the way that they play because they are this post-punk. So a lot of angular stuff and just kind of like discordant guitars you're going to hear from time to time. I think with this album Change, they really smoothed it all out. With this kind of meditative drum work over just really warm bass lines that just ride the whole album all the way through. The singer has this really nice way of writing songs where they feel a little bit confessional, I guess you could say, but also a bit abstract. He's not telling you about necessarily individual like relationships in his life. He's just got some I don't know, interesting way of writing songs, I guess I should just say that. I remember when I looked this record up on Spotify, because Spotify has the capacity to like songs, and I often do that because I just will listen to an album, and if like two or three songs stick out, I'll be like, I'll pin that song or that song. And there's 11 tracks on here, and I had already pinned 6 of them. So,
oh, nice.
I just love this record. I didn't really even need to go back and listen to it all that much. If you want some recommendations, Sentimental Man, Face of the Earth, Time Bomb, Superpowers. I love all these songs. Again, this is a really easy listen. It's beautiful music, in my opinion. Death Cab for Cutie, releasing another album. I think it was just last year we were talking about a Death Cab album. We Have the Facts and We Are Voting Yes, I think is the name of the album.
That's a weird... All
right. Right, yeah.
It's a lot of words.
So, they're an indie rock band noted for very introspective lyrics. This guy, Ben Gibbard, sings for them, and he has the voice of an angel. He has a very pretty lady man voice, I guess you could say, if you listen to him. Very childlike, I guess you could say. I like it. It's okay. It's fine. Like fucking Death Cab makes too many records. They just, as a band, have released too many fucking records.
Just settle down a little bit.
They really should. It's like they could take a year off every once in a while, but it's like
they're like the Game Freak of the music scene.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. But yeah, it's still very good. Like there's a song on here called We Laugh Indoors that I listened to this album. Really loved that song, and I went back and looked at it, and it's like this is one of those albums where like everybody would listen to it and everybody would have a favorite song, but it would be a different song. You know, it's just different tracks resonate with different people for whatever reason.
I couldn't name a single Death Cab for Cutie song now.
Yeah, that's fine. Well, We Laugh Indoors, you got one.
Well, there you go.
All right, Incubus. You guys probably know who Incubus is, right?
Yeah, I like Incubus.
From Calabasas. They released an album called Morning View, which had some big songs for them. Nice to Know You, mm-hmm. Wish You Were Here, and yep. Warning.
Okay.
So this album would go double platinum. I saw it references nu metal. I never really thought these guys were nu metal. I've always taken them for more of like a funk. Like, I don't really know what to describe these guys as. Like, I don't know. At any rate, if you're going to call these guys nu metal, this has to be like the most hippie-ish, softest nu metal there is. They're very genteel. Their music is actually very nice. Again, these singles are really, really good, especially Wish You Were Here. I really enjoy that song a lot. Nice to Know You is quality. I remember someone writing that, like, they were basically saying, like, in one of their critical reviews, they were like, they want to sound deep, but I don't think they are that deep. Which is a pretty good way to describe it. But very pleasant music. Very pleasant music. Again, the album's called Morning View. Just sounds nice. Garbage released an album called Beautiful Garbage. This was kind of a disappointment for them because the prior albums they had were all like multi-million selling jams, and this one kind of struggled to break even. The reviews were incredible for this one. And even if you go back and listen to it, I listened to it, nothing really stuck with me, so I can't say it's even a good record. But you could tell they produced their own album, Garbage does, and always have. And they clearly spent a lot of time in the studio just tinkering, making this album sound special. So even if the songs aren't really there or super catchy or built for radio, if you are a fan of just kind of the song structures and listening to the way things are recorded, there's just a lot going on with this record. I can't really pinpoint any one specific thing. Again, there was too many records this month. Too many records to really sit down and digest all of this. A band called Pulp released We Love Life. It is their final album. They were a Britpop band. One of the definitive Britpop bands of the 90s. I only bring it up to say that it's their final album. I don't like pulp that much. Tomahawk. Tomahawk released their self-titled record, and I like this band. It is a combination of members of the Melvins, Jesus Lizard, and Helmet, all of whom are big sludge metal bands. If you were into that kind of music, you probably know who they are. Their singer is Mike Patton, who you will know did the Ninja Turtles theme song from that Ninja Turtle game they've been playing.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, so Mike Patton's wonderful. He is himself in a million fucking projects, too, including things like Faith No More and Mr. Bungle.
And Ninja Turtles.
And, of course, the Ninja Turtles. Yeah, you know, if Casey Jones was a real person, it probably would be Mike Patton.
Mm.
You know, I'm sure he's got the golf bag with the hockey stick and everything, too.
Cricket bat.
Yeah, gotta have a cricket bat. So yeah, it's a good record, if a little unpretty by design. I would say I can listen to it, but like Tomahawk, again, is going to release a bunch of records, so fucking whatever. Pinback. Pinback releases an album called Blue Screen. I've always heard of Pinback, but I never really listened to Pinback. And it was just kind of weird, because like they're in the emo scene, and they're a big band in the emo scene. But they never really got a hold of these guys for some reason. But I enjoyed this album well enough. The opener track is the best track, which kind of sucks because it's downhill from there. It's called Offline PK, which I hope means like player killer. Offline PK means you're going into other people's games when they're like taking a break or something. You're just killing their characters.
Maybe he's like psychokinesis, like he's got some sort of like telekinetic.
Ooh.
It sounds to me like they're hunting them down in real life.
No, that's even scarier.
It is the most dangerous game.
There was an anime that did that.
Really?
The Sword Art series.
Oh, Sword Art Online. Yeah, everyone gets trapped in the game or whatever.
Yeah, the other season, he's in a different game called Gun Gill Online. And there was a guy who was claiming that...
He got out of that game and the game got back in another game?
Yeah, oh, what a dickhead.
And then he
rein it in, fellas.
Sorry. Character who... He said, if I kill your avatar in the game, you die in real life. And that was happening, but it was... I don't know, whatever. It was a show.
Okay, Pinback, Blue Screen. It is an indie rock album. If you like intricate guitar rock, you're probably going to like this one. Offline PK is really good. Penelope is real good. Brian Jonestown Massacre released an album called Bravery, Repetition, and Noise. It's their sixth album. They're kind of a psychedelic rock band. I don't necessarily know this is that great of a record. I enjoyed it, though. It's kind of got a garage rock thing going for it. Pretty lo-fi. Has a song called Nevertheless. Really enjoyable. Hip-hop, really diverse, if not that many records in hip-hop. You've got a East Coast record, a West Coast record, a record from South, and you've got an old head releasing a record as well, and they are, let's just get through them. Masta Ace releases Disposable Arts. He's in from New York. I often talk about how like a lot of these records have like lo-fi beats. This is an album with like hi-fi beats. This is an album that literally has like Foley work all over it. It's kind of crazy. Even if it's not like... that catchy or all that enjoyable, it is headphone candy of a record. Like, this is almost like they're making a movie score or something, and it's just like skits are one of the most skippable things on hip-hop albums, in my opinion. You oftentimes will see like they have 20 something tracks and five of them are skits, and it's like they're just telling jokes and shit. They like have like professional sound studio work done on their skits.
Okay.
Like, I don't know why, but it's really, really, it's a really nice record produced by Explicit and Domingo. So I would recommend it. Masta Ace, Disposable Arts. It's one of the better reviewed albums in hip hop for the year. A lot of people really, really liked that one. So, Dilated People, they are from LA. They released an album called Expansion Team, and I fucking love this record. It is so, so good. Produced by The Alchemist and DJ Premier, who we brought up many, many times, and also an in-house producer who is part of Dilated Peoples. DJ Babu produces a lot of tracks on here. It just sounds fantastic. It's all over. It has that really fun West Coast vibe to it, but it's not sort of like it's aping Dr. Dre or anything. It's got its own thing. If you guys remember last year, we talked about Jurassic 5's Quality Control, and that was a phenomenal record. This is in the same vein. If you like that, you will certainly like this record. Very, very good and strongly recommended. T.I. released I'm Serious. T.I. is from Atlanta. This is his debut record. T.I. is going to be a bigger name in the game in the mid-2000s and on. He is going to be largely credited as the creator of trap music. And trap is, like, gonna fucking take over. It is going to be for like 15 years after it, like kind of, it's only recently that trap really feels like it's died out as the de facto hip hop genre, for the mainstream. And you know, like trap music, basically means like drug dealer music. It's like he's documenting a lifestyle. He's not he's not a particularly good rapper, especially on this record. He sounds like very average rapper, and his voice hasn't really fully formed. You can tell he's still pretty young and trying to figure out what he wants to sound like on a record, and his rhymes aren't very good. But he's got this guy DJ Toomp behind him, T-O-O-M-P.
You said you were okay, gosh.
No, yeah, I mean, he'd fucking shoot me in the face if he heard me say what I just said.
And he's here today!
No, but he got this guy DJ Toomp, who's worked with the likes of MC Shiedy and 2 Live Crew, these artists going back into the 80s from the Miami scene. Really, really good. I like this guy. I like this producer a lot. T.I. will make better records, and trap music itself will be this interesting melding of the Miami-based scene with what is then going on in Southern hip-hop with the likes of the No Limit, Cash Money, that kind of stuff. You're going to meld all that together, and you're going to eventually find your way into what is trap music that just sells a lifestyle. This is very much like Bro Country, the way that Bro Country sells that like dirt road cold beer thing. That's very much what he is. He is marketing to kids the life of a small, like, well, who wants to be big time drug dealer, pimp, that kind of shit. So really kind of garbage lyrical content on top of that.
He's corrupting the youths.
He's the guy that they should be worried about.
As they listen to this while they're playing Grand Theft Auto.
So here's the thing, and we kind of have to talk about this. There are 7 different topics on him associated with legal issues.
At the same time?
Over the course of his life, including multiple cases of assault, being in jail, possessing assault rifles, with his wife coordinating an effort of drugging and raping people, including men. Over 30 people have accused him of this, of drugging them and raping them.
I mean, you don't want to be sexist.
So he's currently... this is an ongoing lawsuit that he's dealing with. It sounds like he's very much like... that dirtbag producer, Harvey Weinstein.
Mm. Or a former president.
Yeah, or a former president. Got wrapped up in a crypto scheme.
Oh my God.
Was accused by his own daughter of performing hymen checks on her until the age of 16. Gross, fucking gross. This is a guy that...
What a fucking weirdo.
This is a guy that raps about pimping other women. Mm. And he's like gonna do like a purity test on his own daughter. He's a fucking... creep.
Uh-huh.
And can I joke about one thing?
Yes.
Unrelated to that, certainly. He's also
credited, nothing if not reverent on this show.
He is credited for saving the life of Scott Stapp, the singer of Creed.
How dare he?
He apparently, I guess, was neighbors with him, and Scott Stapp wanted to commit suicide.
That's a block party I want to go to. Not the suicide, but the Scott Stapp.
He apparently jumped out the window. I guess his house wasn't as big as he hoped it would be to kill himself. And first...
It's a one-story house. I don't understand.
First to respond on the scene was T.I. It got him medical treatment. And if not for that, he probably would have died. And like Scott Stapp said that he saw the face of an angel when T.I. approached him. It was a funny read. After going through this horror show of terrible things this guy's done in his life, to get to the part where he saved Scott Stapp's life was just comedy. I couldn't help but forget.
God, what a life.
Right? Oh my God. So T.I., absolute dirtbag, but he will be super influential in the coming years. And DMX releases Great Depression. This is a real letdown album. DMX, to this point, was like a beast hardcore rapper. Like, on par with the likes of a Jay-Z. You know, that new generation of Notorious B.I.G. And he releases a very just average album. He's Kelly's phoning it, and he's not even really trying.
He's looking for a paycheck.
Yeah. Kellis, or Kellis, however you say it. You remember that song, Milkshake?
Yep.
Yeah, this is Kellis. This is who did it.
Oh, is this the album?
No, it's not that album, though. This is an album prior to it called Wanderland, and it is really, really good. The whole album is produced by the Neptunes. It's a big old slab of like neo soul. She sounds great. Her voice is really, really great. I like it a lot. Flashback, Popular Thug, some really good songs. 70 minutes long is way too fucking long, but it's good.
That's a journey.
Moving into punk. I'll start getting through these as fast as I can. Fugazi releases The Argument, their final album as a band. Fugazi is important because it contains members of Rites of Spring, one of the original emo bands, and Minor Threat, the original straight edge hardcore band. And it's an interesting record. I don't know. I don't like that. I honestly hate to say it. I'm not a big Fugazi guy. Love Minor Threat. Love Rites of Spring. Aside from the very early Fugazi material, I don't like when they kind of mellowed out, and this is very much a mellow out point in the band's career. It's still good. It's still like a worthwhile listen, but you would not be the least bit surprised. I mean, when I first listened to the first like song, I honestly thought it was just like a stripped down Red Hot Chili Peppers or something. It's just, I don't know. Anyway, moving on. Brand New releases Your New Favorite Weapon.
I listened to this one.
You did?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I really liked it. Yeah. I see that on the website it's only got like a 67 user score. To each their own. This one, it reminded me a lot of Taking Back Sunday. Because it had like it's got like the same sort of like pop rock feel to it, or like maybe slightly emo, but the dual vocalist especially reminded me a lot of Taking Back Sunday. Like the first song especially, like when I hit play in the playlist and the first song kicked in, I was like, wait a second, is it playing the right thing?
Yeah.
And no, it did, I really liked it. I thought it was really good. I listened to this one twice.
Oh, nice. Yeah, the shower scene. There's a lot of really really good songs on this one, and not even you said dual vocals. It's actually three different guys in the band have mics, so they actually do a lot of harmonies on this record, which I think helps. It is, like you're saying, very, very pop punk in an emo mindset. They're going to deviate from this sound pretty big. If anything, they're going to be the emo band that like has grander ambitions for, you know, creative music. And they will always remain this emo band, but this is certainly their big pop punk album.
Mm.
After this, they're going to have an album called Déjà Entendu. And then after this, an unbelievable record called The Devil and God Are Raging Inside Me, which it's wild to think of where emo can go based on what we're used to hearing with the likes of this. And like you're saying, Taking Back Sunday or Dashboard Confessional, that kind of sound. You know, they do a lot with this. It's just a really good record. I think that it captures a lot of that fun energy. The vocals are fantastic, and it's just super catchy all over the place. Really like that a lot. A band called Carry On released A Life Less Plagued. So Fugazi kind of invents straight edge, or Minor Threat creates straight edge hardcore. Carry On, A Life Less Plagued, is a straight edge hardcore band. It's, I believe, 12 songs in 18 minutes. This one is
efficient.
Right. This one is blistering. It's so tightly wound. I absolutely love this record. It's really, really good. And I think one of the, and it's weird to say this, and it's almost kind of shady to say it, this is a fun record to actually play at half speed. It's the kind of record, it is just so fucking fast that when you slow it down, it becomes this delightfully meathead hardcore record where all of this like frantic chaos that you're hearing gets slowed down. And one, you can actually kind of make out what's going on. And because it's so slowed down, all of these like mosh pit moments happen in the record that probably weren't intended. Fun. Bane, a band from Worcester, Massachusetts called Bane, releases Give Blood, another hardcore band, another straight edge hardcore band. So this is the month for it. 10 tracks, 25 minutes. The guitarist from Converge, well, the other Converge has two guitarists. There's Kurt Ballou, and then there's the other guy, I forgot his name. The other guy, whose name I am not remembering right now, is in this band Bane. And he would leave Converge and this focus on this as his sole project. And this one is, while Converge is off doing their own thing and creating their own really interesting take on hardcore, this is more straight ahead shit. This is really more like, you know, four on the floor, pit music. It sounds fantastic. I love it. Moving on, Appleseed Cast. They release Low Level Owl Volume 2, having just released Volume 1 like 5 months ago. They did the thing where they split this album apart because it's too much music. They're an emo band. I'd recommend you listen to the first album. We're getting somewhere, man. We're getting close to the end. You said you listened to four.
Yeah.
You only missed one, though.
Right.
Okay, hopefully some of these will be captured in what I'm about to say. Aphex Twin releases Drug Use. Okay, so Aphex Twin is kind of frequently bring up IDM and Glitch, and that's because this is sort of the peak of it, and if anybody is responsible for it, it's Richard D. James, who is Aphex Twin. Drug Use is 100 minutes and 30 tracks.
Oh, my God.
He apparently, what had happened was he had his music stored on like an iPod. He had it digitally stored somewhere. and it got stolen. And rather than risk it being released without his consent or without his production, he quickly kind of organized it and put it into an album and released it released it himself. And what it amounts to is all of this genius that we've seen from him since that he's been releasing since the early 90s, just in these very short bursts. Again, you know, 30 tracks is so much music. Some of it is just solo piano. Some of it is the same kind of breakcore we've come to expect from him. Some fun throwbacks, too, just like his older music. It's absolutely fantastic, and it's just... It's a shame this had to come out in a month like this, where I didn't really get to spend nearly as much time as I wanted to with this record. It is genius. It is a watershed moment for him as a producer. Sadly, he is going to release only... Richard D. James, the guy behind the project, will release tons and tons of records. There is literally only going to be one more record from Aphex Twin after this, and it's going to come out in 2014.
Oof, it's quite a break.
Right, it's going to be a long fucking time before he comes back to doing anything associated with Aphex Twin, which is so, so sad. And he kind of got yelled out of the business for it, too. This album got really bad reviews. People were accusing him of phoning it in, and I think that they had heard the story about him. Like, they called it an album dump. They just called him dumping all of this music that he didn't care about, and it's fucking... No, it's not. Not at all. There's so... Every song here has its meaning and its message. Even if there's, like, a couple of weird songs here and there, it's all stuff that if you had followed his music prior to this, it would make sense. And I think that's very sad. And also, noted Sad Sacks, noted Wet Blankets at NME, that English, the album reviewing website, they gave this like a 10 out of 10. They were like, this is the crowning, like everyone else is giving this 2 out of 5s and saying it's garbage and it's trash. And they're like, 10 out of 10, this is everything we knew he was capable of all at once. And we haven't even begun to figure out what this album means. They reviewed it again 6 months later and gave it another 10 out of 10, saying we've now had a chance to really make sense of this.
Wait, we listened to the whole thing now.
It is genius. This is so fucking good. And it is. I love it. Okay, moving on. And that was, by the way, that was the album of the month on the album of the year website for October. This is the album. If you only listen to one, apparently they say that was it. So, moving on. Akira Yamayoka? Releases the Silent Hill 2 soundtrack.
I did listen to this one.
Okay, what'd you think?
You know...
Off to a good start.
that was a really pregnant pause. That pause was in its third trimester. It was fine. Like, some really nice piano arrangements. Yes. A lot of the tracks were just kind of like ambient tones, not really so much like songs as you would like think of as... Like in a Mario game, or like some of the more bombastic video game music, but it's a horror game, so a lot of these things are just kind of like backdrop to the setting rather than some of this sort of driving the progression forward. So for what it was, yeah, I thought it was pretty good. Like there's a lot of tracks as you know you would have in a video game. Video games always have a ton of tracks, and you know, nothing that really struck me as repetitive either. There wasn't like to the point where things got annoying because I was hearing the same things over again. I thought I had a good variety to it, and none of the tracks repeated themselves, just like within like a little time loop or anything. But it's background music. It's very very like creepy, scary background music, and I just had it like playing in the background in my office while I was working at work. And I'm sure like people walking by, I was like, "What the fuck's going on there?" I was like, "Shut up! It's Halloween. We're listening to Silent Hill 2."
Yeah, I think that's a very good way to put it. You're right, it is a combination of dreary ambient, ominous-sounding solo piano, and a surprising little sound of trip-hop dirges, is what I would call them. It's sort of trip-hop tracks that are just, again, a little dreary. A little drearier than you would expect them to be.
It's like a funeral procession.
Right. And the only thing that feels so strange is that every once in a while you get those big rock songs. It's like a character. If you read the titles, it's like so-and-so's introduction.
Yeah, it's like their rock song. Title track. This guy is awesome. Here he comes.
I feel like those. If you take out those three or four songs that are like that, what you have is a really good ambient mix. I think it works well, and it really is evocative of a game I remember playing, and one that really does get you in the mood. There's a bunch so I'm just going to burn through a couple real quick here. Stars of the Lid releases the Tired Sounds of Stars of the Lid. And this is a follow-up to an album called Avec Laudanum. It is true deep ambient drone. I love this stuff. It is, for me, this is the kind of meditative music I like to sleep to. The album's over 2 hours long. It is a long one. Yeah, totally worth it. Essentially, what they did is record classical instruments, things like violins and cellos and stuff like that. And then just sort of, rather than trying to like play notes on them in a specific order to create melody, they sort of just let them stretch out. They'll just kind of hold the tones, and then they layer them over one another, and it creates this really blissed out music. Very good to sleep to. An artist named Cornelius released an album called Point. This one ended up being really popular, even though I'd never heard of it. It's a very lean production. It's this style called krautrock. It's got, it's really headphone music. I think that it's not super catchy, but it is really meant for headphone music. A throwback you guys may remember. Do you guys remember this, the Silver Mountain Zion Memorial Orchestra? We talked about them. They're an ambient band. They released an album called something like "He Has Left Us, But the Light Still Graces the Corners of the..."
Right, the super long album titles.
Get this, they added three new members to the band.
Amazing.
They are now the Silver Mountain Zion Memorial Orchestra and Tra-La-La Band. I kid you not. Born into Trouble as the Sparks Fly Upward is the name of their new effort.
Well done.
It's fucking great. It's again, these are all members behind this other band with a long name called Godspeed You Black Emperor. What it is, it's a very cinematic record. It's the same thing you heard on the other one, very dreary arrangements of strings, piano, cello, violins, a little piano, occasionally guitar. But for the most part, it's just very drony, white noise music. And I think it's beautiful in its own way, in kind of a sad way. It's very pretty. And get this, they weren't done. The Godspeed wasn't done. There's another spinoff band.
Oh my goodness.
Set Fire to Flames. They released an album called Sing Rains Rebuilder, which... is going to sound very much alike the other band, different in some ways. This one tends to focus more on guitar and drum and big build-ups. The hook behind this record is that they were recording it in a house that was about to be demolished. So there's kind of when you hear the ambient background stuff, it's of an actual house. So you kind of have to keep that in the back of your mind when you're listening to it. And you're like, why are their floorboards creaking? Why do you hear like this indistinct chatter? Why are cars? Do you hear the sound of a siren at one point drive by the house? Like, if you care about that kind of stuff, it's there, whatever. Dental, D-N-T-E-L, releases an album called Life is Full of Possibilities. It is a sophisticated, pretty IDM album. Ben Gibbard from Death Cab for Cutie and Dental are going to make a group called The Postal Service, which is going to release one of the best albums of the 2000s in like 3 or 4 years. So put a pin in that. In the meantime, Dental's Life is Full of Possibilities, fucking great record. Really, really good. Absolutely beautiful. Sweet melodies. There is a song with Ben Gibbard on here, and I think it sounds really nice. Rhythm and Sound, German duo making sort of a dub techno, sort of combining Detroit techno with dub, the 70s style of Jamaican reggae where they're scratching up records. You wouldn't think it should work, but it does. Again, the artist is called Rhythm and Sound. I absolutely love it. It's great. Like, it's sort of like if you think that dub is too like kind of slow and drugged out and monotonous, or you think that like techno is like too, I don't know, plodding, they work well together. It kind of they kind of soften the rough spots of each other. Lastly, Loxil releases Triple Point, Vancouver based ambient techno, not dub techno, ambient techno. Really good record. If the beats feel a little perfunctory, they feel a little slapped on, I think this would actually work better as a beatless ambient record. That's just me. Can I give you 4 quick metal records?
Do
and
it.
Then we're done. Okay.
Oh, we're not done.
Okay. Silencer releases an album called Death Pierce Me. Here's another one of your weird genres. So black metal, more than anything else, loves subgenres. They love creating little sneaky little subgenres in all of their music. This one is called Suicidal Depressive Black Metal.
Okay.
And if I played this for you, you would think it was a fucking joke. So it is raging Swedish black metal, right? Like, it's got the tremolo riffs that are going fucking crazy, machine gun drum work. And then this guy comes in with just the most, like, manic yelp. The way that he sings is just so silly sounding. It's the kind of like the wailing of a child or something. It's hard to describe. And when you listen to it, you're like, how can... I remember when the vocals first came in, I knew this was going to be kind of weird music, but when the vocals first came in, I was like, I just sort of stopped, and I was like, that's what we're doing here? Like, that's what we're going for? only to find out that the reason why it is the way that it is because the guy singing it, again, that's why you call this genre suicidal depressive black metal. He's engaging in self-harm as he sings. So he's like cutting himself up.
And that's not great.
Again, this is the black metal scene for you. This is the most extreme of the extreme. Again, it's all very, I mean, I constantly refer to it as theatrical. And this guy's clearly struggling with mental health issues. He's still alive. He's not dead. So, you know, this album didn't take him, at least. So that's that. Sodom releases M16. This is the third month in a row we're talking about a German thrash metal band. And this album slays. This album is so, so much fun. I absolutely love it. It's their 10th record, apparently, as a band. They've been recording since the mid-80s. I love it. We were talking about Destruction, I think, 2 months ago, and Creator the month before that. This one really rips. It's very, very good. Forest of Shadows releases Where Dreams Turn to Dust. 3 tracks, 30 minutes. It is a true-to-form doom metal album, so very slow churning, very guttural vocals, very heavy wall of distortion, and very slow pace. There's a kind of grandeur to it. Lastly, Godflesh. Godflesh releases Hymns. Godflesh is the product of a guy named Justin Broderick. Justin Broderick is really, really big in industrial metal, but also specifically grindcore. He was the singer and guitarist of Napalm Death when they released a seminal album in 1987 called Scum. And it is sort of the definitive grindcore record. People say that this is sort of a touchstone record for grindcore. He would leave the band after that record, though. Hmm. So he's kind of doing his own thing, and his own thing is now Godflesh. And this album isn't really grindcore. It's more like sledge metal, kind of like that Tomahawk record, just even more like pissed off. And the guitars are just fucking amazing on it. There's this big wall of sound guitar work. If anything, it actually reminds me a little bit of Pantera. It's got kind of like Pantera sort of like dirtbag thrash metal sound to it. I love it. Probably the best metal record of the year. Or not year, month. And that's it. That's all the music, you guys. Thank you for letting me.
There are a couple more.
What did I miss? There are a couple more. I missed me? What did you miss?
Le Tigre, Feminist Sweepstakes. Was one of the...
Oh, really?
Yeah, one of the punk albums for the year. Wasn't this one?
I like Le Tigre.
I don't know anything about this band. I listened to the full album. I really like this one. It is... I don't know for sure, but two ladies and a gentleman in this band. A lot...
Sounds like a sitcom.
Yep.
Yep.
And of course the ladies are, one of the ladies is the lead singer, so a lot of the songs are female empowerment, but it's a punk album. Like it's got a lot of energy, it's got like a lot of driving like rock, power chords.
British Vermin, version of Three's Company, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Are they British?
No. The two housewomen and a gentleman.
Okay, yeah, so you're like, yeah.
Make it your joke. I'm funny, guys.
Yeah, he wears the top hat and a monocle. Yeah, yeah. England.
We can do this. Yeah, yeah. We can do this.
Yeah, I thought it was really good. I had a good time listening to that one. The other one that I listened to was a Funeral Dress, Way of Life.
I have no idea what that is. Who is Funeral Dress?
No idea. But I listened to this album. It came out October 1st of 2001. This is an album that felt so out of time. Like, I started listening to it, and I thought I was listening to a 1985 American hardcore punk band.
I've never heard of these guys.
I thought this was a really fun album. I forgot to write down some of the standout tracks, but yeah, it was just like driving power chords and like the vocals. I could have been listening to like Black Flag or somebody. I thought this was a really good one.
Oh wow! Yeah. So these guys have they're from Belgium and they've been recording since '85.
Okay,
so
I like Belgium.
Yeah,
I like 1985.
I've been there.
Yeah. I've been to 1985.
I have not.
I wasn't there for very well. I was there for 365 days. I don't remember any of it.
Oh, I thought you were sitting there and go back in time.
So it must not have been that memorable.
I suppose. Anyway. And then, so yeah.
I listed like 35 albums, dude.
Yeah, and those two, I think those two are absolutely worth going back and taking a listen to.
Let's see, great. I love Let's see, great. That's great.
And then the last one I need to mention, I haven't listened to this one in a long time. I didn't realize that this one had come out, otherwise I would re-listen to it again. But the Cranberries release Wake Up and Smell the Coffee.
Oh, I missed that one.
The
I mean, with 35 albums, it makes sense.
The singles for that one were Analyze and Time is Ticking Out. This was like, the Cranberries definitely had like their height of popularity in the mid-90s. So this wasn't... a particularly standout album, in my opinion. But this was notably their last studio album until 2012. It went a really long break.
Yeah.
What was really cool about this album, though, was in the UK, they did some bonus tracks from their Live in Paris show, which I think they did in 2001. But if you get a chance to YouTube will have the whole 2001 Live in Paris concert available in full. If you get a chance, go ahead and indulge in that, because there was a really good live show that they did.
Yeah, I see they do "In the Ghetto" by Elvis Presley.
Did they really?
To come full circle. Yeah, that's part. It says that's part of their UK bonus tracks.
Oh right. Yeah.
Oh no, that was not Live in Paris though. "Dreams and Promises" were the Live in Paris tracks.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's it. That's all the music you could ever want.
Yeah. Jeez.
What do you think? You guys want to take a quick break and then come back with movies?
I'm ready to do movies, yeah.
Cool. All right, here we go. Movies.
Movies.
There's a bunch of them, too.
Oh, my God.
Thankfully, I feel like I don't have that much to say about any one of them.
Retro show's become our biggest show now.
I know, it's so good.
We're a retro podcast now. I love it. This is what we are. Screw Nintendo games. We're just a retro podcast.
No, we're still talking about
Nintendo. We talked about plenty of Nintendo content.
We talked about Mega Man Battle Network.
We did.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the GameCube.
We did.
End of list.
All right.
So I have a few movies as well.
Yeah.
I don't think I wrote down every single one that came out, so we'll kind of fill in the blanks here as we go. Did you watch Joyride?
Did not.
No. Joyride is a horror movie. I didn't watch this one, but I do remember this one, because I remember seeing this one in theaters with a couple of friends.
Yeah.
I think it's Paul Walker, if I remember the cast correctly.
In my mind, I'm imagining the cover art, and Paul Walker is the guy on the cover.
Yes. But they sort of catfish this trucker. We're using the CB radio, and that's sort of like the impetus of the movie, is when when the trucker finds out that Paul Walker is not this sexy lady who's seducing him over a CB radio, turns psycho, just tries to run him off the road over and over again. Super thin premise. It's obviously not a good movie. Really stupid and silly.
Yeah.
And not in a good way. That's it. That's Joyride.
Not in a moonfall way.
Right. It's a high bar, though.
Take my gun.
Training Day?
I didn't actually get around. This is like the one movie that I don't think I had seen that I really wanted to get around to watch, and I did not.
I did not get around to watching.
35 albums.
I managed to see like 4 movies.
So. I have seen a few of these as well. I haven't seen Training Day in a long time either. I wasn't able to get around to this one either, but Denzel Washington, Ethan Hawke. I think Denzel Washington will go on to win an Oscar for this, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
But he's this... The premise is Ethan Hawke's first day training in this new position on a police force, or sort of like a plain clothes division, like detective or something. And yeah. Denzel Washington is, let's say, a not entirely ethical police officer.
Yeah.
And he kind of like going around and showing Ethan Hawke all the corrupt things that he does. You know, is probably not exactly bold filmmaking in August of 2001, but by the time you get to September 2001, we're like, yeah, maybe we're not going to say bad things about the police. Now, here's our movie. We're putting it out.
Yeah.
But hey, really well received. It was a really well reviewed movie.
Mm-hmm.
Mulholland Drive.
Yes, this is actually one of the movies I watched. And it's a movie I've seen many, many times. I love it. Have you seen it? You know much about
no,
it?
I don't think I've ever seen this one.
This doesn't sound familiar to me at all.
So it's made by a guy, David Lynch. Do you know who David Lynch is?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Eraserhead, for example, Lost Highway.
Really grounded dude. Really,
yeah, totally. But very by the numbers.
Down to earth.
No, he is out of his fucking mind with a lot of his stuff. Yeah, he made Twin Peaks as well. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a really, really good director. I love him. Blue Velvet. Oh my god. Yeah, I'm just naming movies he's done. He's a great director, and this is probably one of his more high concept films that he's ever made, which is saying something, because he makes some weird fucking movies. Essentially I've watched it many, many times, and I think there's a lot of different ways to interpret it. What it's about is dreams. It's about people having dreams, and at what point do dreams become reality? Can you live in a dream?
Your dreams be dreams.
Yeah. And what it is essentially about is a woman that loves another woman, that is being rejected by her, while at the same time trying to have a trying to have a film career, but struggling with it as well. And you get a lot of, out of context sequences that maybe don't add up to anything. Abrupt cuts from one thing to the next, kind of in the way that you may dream, and your dream just goes to a totally different place. and you experience that, and then it goes to something else and you experience that. So it's sort of up to you to decide what's real to the story, what's not real, what are just sort of impressions of the subconscious. It isn't out there. This is a month of some pretty experimental and out there stuff, but this is definitely one of the more experimental ones. You kind of have to like David Lynch for it to really click, and you have to go in knowing that it might not make sense. You might get to the end of it and the credits will roll and be like, that was 2 hours and 15 minutes. What the fuck just happened? And maybe not really grasp. Not grasp. It's not like it's totally dense. It's all straightforward. It's just sort of you're questioning what you should take as real and what is just artistically, you know, done.
Hmm.
Love it. Love the movie, though. Really, really good and very much worth watching.
Got Bandits, starring...
Steve Zahn?
Wow.
No. Bruce Willis and...
Oh, I'm thinking of him, yeah.
Billy Bob Thornton. I think this one was actually written by Billy Bob Thornton.
I mean, we learned something about brain tumors.
Yeah.
Did we? I don't remember.
If you smell burning feathers, then you have a brain tumor.
Oh, is that true?
No.
So, Wes, you remember something about this movie.
So... Yeah, I'm surprised how much I do remember about this movie.
Give us the full plot.
I've only seen it once.
Tell us everything you remember, because I remember almost nothing.
So Billy Bob Thornton and Bruce Willis are in this love triangle with this other woman, and they are...
Played by Tim Robbins.
Yeah, and they are what's called the overnight bandits. Well, they'll go to the bank owner's house the night before a bank robbery and stay overnight at their house, and then go early in the morning with the owner to the bank to rob it before it opens.
Go with the bank owner or the manager as a hostage.
Yes, as a hostage. Like, they don't be like, hey, we should do this. No, this is a hostage. So they take them hostage and stay overnight.
They don't, like, talk the manager into it. Like, hey, you're going to join our group.
Yeah, I know, like, general facts, but, like, the other thing is Billy Bob Thornton's, like, hypochondriac and everything. Bruce Willis kind of, like, messes with him. It's like, you know, if you have burning feathers, that's a sign of a brain tumor. And so, like, the rest of the movie is like, do you smell burning feathers? Like, he's, like, freaking out about it. That's, like, one of the things I remember about the movie. But that's the general premise of it. I don't really know.
Do you remember, like, is it, like, a heist gone bad?
I mean, at some point. I mean, they become famous, and, like, at one point they are doing their thing, and the bank owner's like, oh my god, it's you, and they, like, freak out like they're celebrities.
Oh, how strange.
As they're being held hostage. Like, oh my god, I can't believe you're taking us hostage. That kind of thing. That was kind of funny.
So I guess the biggest thing I'm wondering is, like, were Joe Pesci and Daniel Stern not available? Why these two hacks Bruce Willis and Billy Bob Thornton?
Keep in mind, Billy Bob is in another movie this month, too. So he's spread kind of thin. He's probably phoning it in.
I never liked Billy Bob Thornton. I can't think of anything that he was in that I'm like, I enjoyed that.
Bad,
like,
Santa.
No.
Really? Okay.
No. I just don't like Billy Bob Thornton.
Blood Simple?
He's been in
a couple of Coen movies.
The two movies I'm thinking of are so unalike and yet very similar, but there's Apollo 13 and Armageddon. Uh-huh, he's in one of them.
He's in Armageddon.
He's in Armageddon?
Yeah, he's the sort of mission control guy.
That's right. Ed Harris is the mission control guy. Yeah,
exactly.
See, you said that, and I just thought of, what is it, Bad News Bears? Is that what the name of the movie?
Where the children play baseball?
Yeah.
Yes.
Popped in my head.
He's in the remake of Bad News Bears.
Okay.
Oh, that's a remake.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Of a movie, I think it was in the 70s with Walter Matthau.
Yeah. I can't speak to the quality of this movie, but it's directed by Barry Levinson. He's made a ton of great movies, like The Fucking Diner, The Natural, Rain Man. Sleeper is a brutal film. Wag the Dog. That shitty sci-fi film, Sphere.
Oh, sure. Another one.
That was him. He did that.
It would be interesting to go back and actually watch this and see.
Yeah.
Because I watched it as a kid, and not as a kid, but, you know, when I was younger.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Anybody watch Corky Romano?
Fucking, you know we didn't.
Starring SNL alum Chris Kattan. Kattan had, like, a 6-week period where everyone thought he was hilarious, and then stopped. We all came to our senses.
I don't know who he is. I mean, you're just, yeah, I'm so bad with names.
That's okay. You don't need to know.
Okay.
You skipped one. The American Astronaut. Have you guys ever seen that?
No, I never saw that one.
Black and white Western space musical.
Oh, interesting.
It's a lot of words to explain what's going on with that one. I love it. It's a really fun movie, if a little quirky and offbeat. There's a lot of, again, it is a musical. There's a lot of really good musical numbers in it. It's the premise is that these are people are sort of forced to work in space and like do mining projects.
Oh, how dystopian. Whalers on the moon. We carry our harpoon.
Yeah, it's not far off, honestly, believe it or not. And yeah, it's black and white, so it feels like it's an old Western. And it's one of those movies where you can kind of clearly see the construction paper of the sets in a lot of ways. Like, it's very knowingly cheaply made. But it's really, really good. As far as sort of, like, out there offbeat musicals go, this one's a really fun
space
one.
Space Western musical being cheaply made? Come on.
Yeah, so American Astronaut, like, for
it's
sure.
It's in black and white, Ryan. Come on.
Yeah, if any of that, it's the second movie we'll talk about that's in black and white, so. But yeah, check. I would actually genuinely recommend it. That it's worth a watch. Yeah. If you're looking for, you know, if you've seen, you know, My Fair Lady, and you've already seen The King and I, and you're like, well, what's the next musical I should watch? Maybe American Astronaut. Jesus. All right. Oh, and you also didn't bring up Tremors 3: Back to Perfection.
Oh, that's right. Well, that was direct to DVD.
So.
That's not really justification. That's just a fact. Like, I know I said that as like an excuse to not talk about it. Like, no, that's just what I know about it.
Well, no, because that one is also a feature length film.
It sure is.
Yeah, that was the one where they flew.
The worms? Or the creatures?
Yeah.
Like economy or first class?
Because the first one, there were the giant worms in the ground, and then they'll pull you underground, suck the dude through the tire, center of the tire.
But they were weird. Key to getting the space spice.
Classic.
Yeah. And then the second one, they got legs and infrared vision. They're just little ones, so they'll burst out of the stomach of the worms. And then the third one, they would essentially fart and launch themselves into the air and then glide.
If that's not the actual premise, it should be.
I mean, they called them ass blasters, I think, if I remember correctly. Because they would, like, fire... pop out of the back of them, and they'll go up into the air and then fly around and then crash into people. If I remember correctly, that was Tremors 3.
Yeah, you seem to know a lot about the Tremors franchise.
When I was younger, man.
You see, you could have watched this one. You could.
I will never watch another Tremors movie. You cannot pay me to watch another Tremors movie.
I mean, the first one was genuinely great. The old Western one was a kick. I remember enjoying that.
How about $20? For $20, you wouldn't watch a Tremors movie?
All right, maybe I would for $20.
The bar was so low. This is the first offer.
What he really thought was, I bet you would just give me $20 and I could say I saw it.
I'll sit there watching.
Can you quiz me?
He's going to go in the Clockwork Orange chair.
Oh, my God. For Tremors.
What make you watch Tremors with Beethoven's Fifth playing in the background?
That's all I had there.
Speaking of movies not worth watching, do you guys watch From Hell? Because I did. So this is a...
managed to miss that one.
It's Johnny Depp as a detective and Heather Graham as a sort of love interest in Victorian England. And it is the a sort of adaptation of a Jack the Ripper story. Johnny Depp is a detective. He's trying to track down this person who is killing and eviscerating women, presented to be Jack the Ripper. And my goodness, I don't think that you could take something as inherently like dramatic and tense as a serial killer movie and make it any more or less interesting. My God, this movie is fucking dull as fuck. I think Ian Holm is in it too.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's got Bilbo Baggins and Hagrid.
That's a good one. Oh, wow. May he rest in peace.
And Ian Holm.
Because he died. Ian Holm died a while ago, but...
Yeah.
Hagrid died?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think just a couple of weeks ago in the year of our Lord, 2022.
Oh, no. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, not that old either. He's only 72.
I didn't know he was that old. Damn.
He doesn't look that old, that's for sure.
No, definitely not in like Harry Potter movies. Mm. Of course, you know, he's in 20 pounds of hair.
When one of those Harry Potter movies came out almost 21 years ago.
Oh, God
damn it. He plays the ticket seller in a really great movie called Let It Ride, which has Richard Dreyfuss in it.
Mm.
Fucking love that movie. It's about a deadbeat gambler who keeps hitting on all of his bets. Like, one day he just has this most miraculous look and he keeps hitting on all his bets. It's really, really fun.
Does it take a dark turn at the end?
No, in fact, it's...
Oh, it's an uplifting story?
So delightfully upbeat that you you would think it was a David Lynchian dream.
Yeah, kids, go into your local gambling hall if your dreams can be true.
Oh, no, because Richard Dreyfuss, it was shot on the Hialeah racetrack here in Florida, by the way, so it's also a vivid snapshot of Florida. It looks fucking great. But yeah, like, Richard Dreyfuss is coked out of his mind the whole movie. It's fantastic. He is just bouncing off the walls like a fucking pinball.
Mm.
Like, it's a fun movie.
And yeah, talking about literally or the character?
No, like, in real life, I'm sure he's doing obscene amounts of cocaine.
And then going to film.
On the set of this movie.
But Ian Holm is Jack the Ripper in this movie.
Yeah, he wasn't in Letter, right?
No, he was not. It's like this big reveal. By the time they reveal, you just don't give a shit anymore. It's a movie about murder, and they can't seem to find any way to keep you interested in the stakes.
Yeah, that's pretty. It's pretty shitty.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it's not good.
Jack the Ripper. He was notoriously violent.
Mm-hmm. And like, there's this strange like baby storyline where like Heather Graham's friend has a baby, but then Heather Graham's friend ends up institutionalized and Heather Graham ends up with the baby, and for some reason like there's this baby that's a plot device that just goes nowhere. Whatever, fuck this movie. Waking Life.
Yes, I rewatched Waking Life.
I did not rewatch all of it because that is not a movie that let's say it does not have a driving narrative bringing you forward throughout the movie.
I mean, that description alone almost didn't have a driving narrative.
I think it's appropriate for the movie that it I'm describing.
I didn't know where you're going with this.
It's a web of discussions, essentially, about science and philosophy.
At least, like, front-loaded with a web of lectures. It's just one person talking at you.
Yeah, I think, and it's also rotoscoped. It's animated film. It's rotoscoped, meaning they filmed people in real life doing these things, and then did this kind of washed out animation effect over it. Which I think, if it didn't have that, you would think this movie was just insulting.
It's trading a lot on just like that visual style. That's almost kind of like psychedelic.
Yeah. It feels, I mean, so some of it is actually genuinely interesting to hear the discussions about. Some of it is stuff that resonates today, and I feel like are common things that you hear about when people do get into quote-unquote deep conversations about existentialism and philosophy.
Usually when they're high.
That's a really good way to put it. Yeah, it's very much, it's like getting life advice from a deadbeat Gen Xer who you should never aspire to be like. Mm. And a lot of it is very shallow.
Hey, he just became the manager of the Quick Stop, so...
No, it's the opposite of that. One of the guys is basically telling you that, you know, like, the entire thing is a game, and it's all corporates control everything, and then he pours gasoline on himself and lights himself up.
Got it.
You know, and again, it's kind of that... It's what it felt like to me was, like, you're going to see your dealer to get some weed, and he wants to have a 20-minute conversation about what he's been thinking about.
And you're tolerating it
because... I just want to get away from you. It's like, I think it's great that you think these things, but it's not anything I want
to... Which is why we need to decriminalize it. That way they can just treat it like a pizza delivery and just call any reputable organization to bring you and then just fucking leave.
Uber weeds.
Got it. Yeah.
But yeah, these are not people that feel very aspirational as ones that should be giving. And a lot of it, you have them where it's like, this scientist said yada yada. There's no documenting of who said what.
You know, I heard this thing offhand, and now I'm going to have this stream of consciousness sermon that I'm going to throw at you. There's a certain nihilism to a lot of the things that are saying. It's a lot of words they're stringing together, but then by the time they cut to the next scene, you're like, what the fuck did they even just say? This felt very empty.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know... I remember I was like... I was probably like 22 when I first saw this movie. And even then, I was like, okay. Sure.
I settled down there.
Right.
This was Richard Linklater, wasn't it?
Yeah, and Richard Linklater is fantastic. He's done, like, you know, Dazed and Confused, Before Sunrise... You know, and Before Sunrise and Before Sunset... have these kind of long conversations that are just...
There's even a sequence with Ethan Hawke.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Back again, mind you, from Training Day.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it's Linklater clearly uses this and does this in really interesting ways in some of his other films. But this just... and Scanner Darkly is going to be another rotoscoped film that tells a science fiction narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the fact that it's more narrative makes it a little more enjoyable, but You know, the guy did like fucking School of Rock.
Mm-hmm.
Like, granted, I think any studio director could probably have pulled off School of Rock. I don't think there's the Linklater flair to it, but you know, he's the guy that's behind that project. So I don't know. Yeah, a lot of this is just so up its own ass that even the little bit. Oh, wait, fucking Alex Jones. Alex Jones has a bit in this. The Sandy Hook denier.
Was that who that was? Who had kind of the raspy voice? Was it fucking
the guy with the megaphone driving in the street yelling at people to that mainstream media is bullshit.
That's horrifying.
So he is a before he became famous, he was an Austin politics talk show host, Austin, Texas radio, which is why Linklater knows him, because Linklater's films are very heavily steeped in Texas culture.
There's a sequence in the movie where the guy at the megaphone and kind of had like a Rush Limbaugh sort of.
That's Alex Jones.
Yeah. But I had no idea that was him.
Yeah. And keep in mind, literally, when I was researching this, on 9/11, the day of 9/11, Alex Jones on his radio show said that it was a deep state conspiracy orchestrated by George Bush.
Oh, this fucking guy.
And Linklater gives him a megaphone. And puts him in his movie.
Gross.
And Linklater said after the fact, like, I didn't know who the guy was. I just thought he was funny.
And
that's how much all of this means to Linklater. Every one of these 5 minutes vignettes means shit to him.
And
other than he thought it was interesting.
For anyone listening in 2001, this guy Alex Jones will then go on to defame the survivors of a school shooting of children, young elementary school children, defame them, and basically incite his mob of psychos to harass the survivors of this child shooting, and then go on to owe them $1 billion with a B. So he'll get his comeuppance.
Wait, what was... Like, how?
How what?
How was he... How
is he coming up with that theory?
Like, that doesn't make...
He said because the liberals were trying to go after the Second Amendment. He basically was saying that they were going to use Sandy Hook as a means of restricting gun rights.
And he was attacking them by saying that it was fake and they were crisis actors.
And it didn't really happen.
Oh, God.
All of the people involved in it are putting on a Truman Show style thing.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, real piece of shit.
Oh, and he's like that with everything. Like, you pick the topic, he's got a wild conspiracy theory that is deeply insulting and very anti-Semitic.
And now he owes those people $1 billion.
And yeah, and
no
again,
amount of supplements will fund his fucking debts. He'll have the rest of his goddamn life.
It's a shame it took, 9 years for it to happen, but it did happen, and I think this will be his undoing.
Mm. It will follow him the rest of his life. He will not escape it.
That's a piece of shit.
Yep.
So anyway, I mean, that's the Waking Life. Waking Life, maybe every once in a while there's an interesting... And the ones where it's literally a guy... And I wonder, it's like, is that actually a professor? Even when they have you in the ones where this kid who's, like, just fucking calling people because he can't afford a taxi. Mind you, this is the guy whose advice we're supposed to be taking. Even though he's, like, can't afford it, he just has time to sit in random lectures at the local school. Like, I think it's this... It's like, gosh, I want to learn, but I don't want to get a job. It's kind of what I feel about everybody in this movie.
So, kind of, speaking of vapid nonsense, in a more presentable package, Donnie Darko.
Yeah, Donnie Darko, huh?
Yeah, that's movie.
It's an edgelord anthem right there, man.
Yeah, it really is. So
I've never seen this, but, you know,
I always
talk about Donnie Darko.
I did rewatch it all the way through in two sessions.
It's like a psychological horror drama that's mixed with like Sliding Doors. You know, Sliding Doors is very much about like if you do one thing, one series of events happens. If you do another happens.
Right.
And it's about this kid who is already struggling with schizophrenia. It's actually a pretty good depiction of what schizophrenia must be like.
Yeah, some hallucinations, paranoid delusions.
Yeah, and he sort of has these two paths that are set in front of him, both of which have, in some ways, terrible results. And it's him sort of dealing with the dilemma of what to do and sort of understanding what's going on with his own mind.
And a lot of the narrative is following him and him trying to figure out his own situation and what choices he's making, his just basic interaction with people like his parents or siblings or his therapists, his teachers. And then there's like self-righteous nihilism to a lot of the conversations that he has with particularly people that he sees as like authority figures or rivals. And trying to like call out establishment virtues and that kind of thing. And, you know, so some things are worth taking down, but there's like a lot of edgelord bullshit. It's tear it down, but nothing to, like, there are no actual ideas other than destroy.
Yeah. And it kind of presents him with some uncomfortable and uncompromising things where it's like, he ultimately is deciding, do I choose to end my own life, and in doing so, save the life of a girl who is romantically interested in me but shouldn't be because I'm schizophrenic and I'm extremely dangerous as an individual? It's like, or do I continue to live and expose the town pedophile? And as best we understand, he chooses to die. So, sure, the girl lives, but the self-help guru who has been, you know, assaulting children gets to continue to be the town hero assaulting children.
Mm.
Again, that's a very blunt depiction of the sliding doors scenario he's confronted with, but I think those are the two big things. A girl dies, or, you know, it's a shitty thing. You can tell that he's cool with accepting his own fate, and it is what it is. And then, of course, there's this guy with the bunny mask and the big reveal at the end about what that was all about, and it's like, oh, okay.
Right.
It's also, by the way, supposed to be set in the 80s. I've never seen a movie that feels so trying to be a period piece that feels so unlike the period piece it's supposed to be. Nothing about that felt like the 80s.
Right.
Did not. It felt like it was just perfunctory that it happened to be the 80s. I don't even know why. Because they wanted to use some cool new wave music, I guess, is the idea.
Yeah, there was no reason where it should have been set in the 80s. Or they like make a reference to like voting for Dukakis as opposed to like, I think H.W. Bush they're running against each other.
Yeah, like that was a set piece, and the parents were yelling at the kid about that.
Mm.
Or getting into it with the kids about that.
Yeah, it ended up meaning nothing.
Yeah. Did we say Jake Gyllenhaal's in it? Jake Gyllenhaal's our dude.
Maggie Gyllenhaal as well.
He's the Donnie Darko.
I didn't know that.
Drew Barrymore has a role as one of the teachers.
I also didn't know that. Wow.
Partly responsible for skinny jeans and hoodies. That is, in even the 80s, that's the style he's rocking, because no one dresses like that in the 80s, but he was. You know, he's also apparently listening to like fucking Joy Division at a house party. No.
And further,
that is a way to clear the room to play Joy Division at a house party.
And further establishing, like, it seems like every filmmaker just fervently believes that children are nasty to each other all the time. Like, no, like, outside of like Jake Gyllenhaal and the love interest, I can't remember her name for the life of me, but outside of those two, no children have a positive relationship with each other. Everyone's just a piece of shit, including in a small role, Seth Rogen.
Yeah, that's right. Seth Rogen's kind of a douche in this one.
Mm. Yeah, Seth Rogen's in this movie.
He's got a really small role. It's not like he's just a douche jock.
He's just there to get high in the corner.
Probably one of his earliest roles.
I don't know when Freaks and Geeks came out. But
I think it might have been after this. Yeah. But anyway, neither here nor there.
True.
How many
more movies we got in here? I got one more to talk about that I actually did watch.
But
there's like Riding in Cars with Boys came out.
I didn't watch that one.
I didn't watch it either, but it did make a little bit of the money.
I watched 13 Ghosts, fellas. Me and Des watched it last night.
Yeah.
It's not great. It's not great at all. Tony Shalhoub is in it.
Tony Shalhoub is in another movie we're going to talk about later.
Oh, that's right. Matthew Lillard is also one of the leading roles, and Shannon Elizabeth is in this movie as Tony Shalhoub's daughter. Basic premise, fellas.
Okay.
Of 13 Ghosts.
What must the mom have looked like for Tony Shalhoub to have resulted in that being the kid?
Mm.
She must have been a star.
He's punching way above his weight class.
Right?
So, Tony Shalhoub lost his wife in an accident. I should actually start further back. Matthew Lillard is a psychic medium. He is able to communicate and channel ghosts. He's also, I forget the actual terminology for it, but so like psychokinetic, where he like makes contact with an object or a person, and he can get like psychic glimpses of like their past, their future, like make psychic connections with them. He is helping our antagonist, who's, I can't remember the actor's name, but he's helping them collect ghosts, collect souls, in order to power this mechanism that will open, they call it the Eye of Hell, which will do something. I don't know if it's ever like officially established, like this is what will happen. These are the stakes. This is why we can't let this guy.
Always good for a movie when they're working towards something and you have no idea what it does.
Right.
It's so, always.
Right. And the Tony Shalhoub and family comes into play because in the opening sequence, Matthew Lillard and our antagonist are in this junkyard. And we of course, get the body count going. All these people who are running around in these clear plastic raincoats like they're in Blade Runner are getting, like, murdered by ghosts. And one guy gets, like, chomped in half by a car, like, in the hood and, like, bends in half. There are two sequences where people get folded in half in this movie. It's insane. There's one part where there's this lawyer in the house and a glass door, like, slides down and, like, chops him in half. And you see his two halves, like, bisects him vertically. And you see his two halves slide down, like, the front half slides down and then the back half slides down. And it doesn't even, like, look particularly great. Like, huh, this is just kind of a gross movie, isn't it? But
I do remember, that's, like, the one thing I do remember about this is that it had some pretty grisly deaths.
Right. Right, but it doesn't even like get to the level of like fucking Ghost Ship, yeah. Where like it bisects people horizontally right at the beginning. Like that's their opening sequence.
Yeah,
not like something silly like someone getting eaten by a car. But you think that the antagonist at the beginning is dead because he's got like you see like his throat slashed and he's there sitting in bloody clothes. Like oh my god, he's dead. So this is where Tony Shalhoub comes into play because Tony Shalhoub is allegedly like a long lost nephew and the sole survivor. So the lawyer shows up to his house and he's like, hey, you inherited the house and all this money. Come see the house. And the house is like made of fucking like glass or like clear plastic. So you can see like the walls through all the rooms. And like if you could like maybe describe the decor of this house as like clutter core. There's just like knickknacks and shit everywhere. And as they're touring the house, they find out there's ghosts in the basement and there's little containment cubes. And Matthew Lillard is there. He shows up. He's like, I'm the power guy. I'm here to check the breakers because fuck dialogue. And he's like there to make sure that the ghosts are contained, but then tell everyone to get out of the house. And of course, like the house turns out to be a trap. It's like a mouse trap situation where like they get shut in. I think like House on Haunted Hill did the same thing. And then it becomes like this ticking clock where the longer that they're in the house, the more like the fucking gears inside the house and all the rooms turn. Like rooms will shift around and move like they're in fucking cube. And everybody gets separated. The children, Shannon Elizabeth and the little boy who's... I don't know who's ever been anything else. They all get separated and they're like, oh, we got to find the kids. It's the kids. And the fucking Matthew Lillard. Oh, he is fucking like Matthew Lillarding it up in this movie. He is hamming every scene. He is like 100% committed to this, his role as this psychic. Like he does the Matthew Lillard special where he drools on the floor and like spitting as he talks. It is amazing. He is like bringing all of the energy to every single line of dialogue. And eventually like he like foresees the future and foresees his own death and he buys it, saving Tony Shalhoub because he's like, hide behind this magical shield. There's only room for one of us. I'll just die. Which is this whole like part, like the walls. The walls have all these fucking writing and scribbling all over the place. Like it's in Latin. I don't know what it's actually. It just might be letters. But they're incantations. And as the gears turn and the house moves around, it's unleashing the ghosts. And you get more of these ghosts who suffered different fates. And in the DVD extras, it tells you all about what ghosts suffered what fate. There's a guy, like there's a lady with like... You know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of Cabin in the Woods, how there's that sequence where there's all like the different like gruesome ghosts that they go through in like the Willy Wonka elevator. So all of these ghosts are unleashed, and of course they're wreaking havoc, but it's only like your Tony Shalhoub, Matthew Lillard, the two kids, and then the nanny, who the daughter, like Shannon Elizabeth is the daughter, and at the beginning of the movie she was like cooking for everyone. I don't know why they need a nanny, neither here nor there. She's there too.
The nanny has her feet up.
And then, this other lady shows up, and you see her in the beginning sequence where the dude gets munched up by the car, and she's like, I'm here to stop you. We need to stop the eye of hell from opening. But it turns out she's not. She's a mole. Because she's there to actually help the antagonist who you thought died at the beginning. And he shows up. He's like, I'm actually alive. And she's like, I'm in love with you. He's like, I know, but I'm going to let you die. And he does. And he's still got like the throat slash makeup on it. Even though it's supposed to be fucking months later. Why are you still in your bloody clothes? You weirdo. What the fuck is going on in this movie? So Matthew Lillard and Tony Shalhoub, they go looking for the kids.
Did it look fresh? The throat slit? He like does it every morning? Like this is just...
Right. Right. It's not like the makeup prosthetic isn't peeling off.
John Hawk can wear the skinny jeans.
He was available for one day of shooting, and they did this scene after he was in makeup, so they're like, don't just roll with it. So everybody gets separated, including the nanny, who's really just there to deliver the last line of dialogue about how white people are crazy. She happens to be a black woman. She's not wrong. And Matthew Lillard, Tony Shalhoub, they take a piece of the wall, the glass, like clear plastic wall, it has the Latin writing on it, and they use it as a shield to block the ghost. And there comes a point where like there's like a corner. It's like, oh, the ghost is coming. Tony Shalhoub, hide behind the magic wall. Matthew Lillard will just die. And he does. So Tony Shalhoub is just trying to get his kids out, and of course, like he's supposed to be like the 13th ghost. If he dies, it'll shut down the machine, but it's all a facade. He can't die, otherwise the eye of hell opens up and something happens. I don't know. So Tony Shalhoub finds his kids because he wasn't able to find them before because they were like stashed away because his wife is there. His wife is one of the ghosts. She's the fourth ghost. And she's like there and he's got like the half burn because she died in a fire. It was a very gruesome death. He was very depressed about it.
Bonkers.
And in the end, they thwart it somehow. I don't know. Something happened.
Power Christ. I don't know.
Yeah. And as they're leaving the house, like, we all made it out alive. There's the ghost of Matthew Lillard. He's leaning up against one of the walls, cleaning off his sunglasses, doing something nonchalant. They're like, Matthew Lillard, just be as nonchalant as possible as you watch them leave. You smile and shake your head and then depart to the afterlife. And it's the one time Matthew Lillard has been casual and not just a complete spaz.
Only took him dying.
Yeah, but that's 13 ghosts. It's not good.
As the family departs from the house, Maggie angrily declares that she is quitting as their nanny.
Yep.
I can imagine that.
They just inherited all this money, and she's quitting.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I just remember this is a horror film with kind of a grisly body count. That was kind of the big thing about this. I remember that at the time, this was one of the more mainstream bloodbath kind of movies.
Mm.
But yeah, that's pretty pretty bullshit plot. Do they really don't know? I guess... I don't want you to go through the whole plot again, but did they not really establish like what the overarching thing above this is that could potentially be like the eye of hell? Like, who's the puppet master? Who's the one controlling all this stuff? Is just fucking ghosts exist and it's
no. It was the antagonist I was talking about who like faked his death.
Uh-huh.
He was the puppet master trying to open it because it would do something for him.
Okay,
it would make him powerful or something. Whatever.
Cool.
Event Horizon. And he was
working with Matthew Lillard because he needed to collect souls as a sort of mechanism to open it up.
Gotcha.
Which is why they had ghosts in containment cubes in the basement.
Dear God.
What else we got?
I think that just about... I got one more movie I want to talk about, and that's it.
Cool.
That's The Man Who Wasn't There.
I did not get to see this yet.
Oh,
but I'm gonna.
It's a good one.
It's on my list.
Yeah, so it's a Coen Brothers film. And I guess if we just look back, they had just come out with Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, mm-hmm. about a year prior to this.
Yeah.
This is kind of a smaller scale project for them, a smaller film. It has Tony Shalhoub in it. But the main character is Billy Bob Thornton. And the premise is that this is 1950s America. And he... is a barber in a town, and he believes that his wife is having an affair with somebody. He tries to extort the guy that's having an affair, tries to get money from him, and in doing so, kills him. So it's not like he's like, I'm mad about this guy cheating with my wife, I'm going to go murder him. He's sort of like, can I make some money off of this?
Mm.
And
in typical Coen fashion, a simple crime goes awry.
Yeah, could you believe it? And to the point where his own wife is, through the evidence presented there, believed to have been the murderer.
Oh, shit.
And becomes the main suspect in it. So you're watching her get put on trial for a murder she knows she didn't commit. Her own husband hasn't really spilled the beans that he was the one that killed her. And then Tony Shalhoub is this high-priced lawyer. Again, you remember the name of his character. He's Lenny Riefenstahl. Like, it's fucking Shalhoub fucking giving it to you. He is amazing. He's magnetic when he is on screen. And yeah, he's the lawyer that's brought in. Like, there's this really great line where it's like, whatever. He's like, I'm going to find you a way out of this. He's saying this to the wife that's on trial for him. He's like, I'm going to find you a way out of this. You didn't hire Lenny Riefenstahl to hold your hand during a sentence hearing. Like, he's like, I'm going to find a way to get you out of this fucking scenario. And then there's this great line where the three of them are at this table, and he's like, I did it. He just confesses. He's just like, I murdered him. And he's like, because I knew she was having an affair. And then you can just see he's looking around, and he's just like, nobody would believe it. But Frances McDormand, who is his wife, is staring at him, and she, like, it's this wonderful moment where the two of them are reading the scenario totally different, and she knows that he knew the whole time, and that he just legitimately confessed to the murder. Like, it's this chills moment in the movie. And the movie has so many really, really interesting moments in it that it's hard to describe. And I think the thing about Billy Bob Thornton portraying this character, Ed Crane, is that Ed Crane's a very boring guy. He doesn't say much. He really doesn't talk much. He's very in himself the whole time. He doesn't ever, ever show emotion. He kind of...
Heard for Billy Bob.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of one of the things. It's like, how do you gauge his performance in this when it seems like he's so willfully keeping it all inside? And it does create this really... And like ambient music, it kind of creates this beautiful performance that you kind of just got to get into to really appreciate. It's fantastic. It's definitely an homage to noir. It's black and white, of course. There's a lot of just those really abstract scenes the Coens like to do. A lot of filming in complete white environment. Not a lot of it, but occasionally they'll break into these very abstract things where it's like the wall, everything is painted white. So there is no dimensions to the room. It's infinite, you know. And it's a lot of just sort of transferring into this his mind's eye, I guess, as he's experiencing some of this. Again, just some wild ass, over the top Coen-esque characters. James Gandolfini is the guy having the affair with his wife. It's one of the ones that's overlooked. It's definitely overlooked in the Coen brothers canon, and they've made so many big famous movies. I think this is a really fine one and deserves to be watched. Oh, and you get a fairly young Scarlett Johansson in this, who has a one of those that kind of makes you go back and think about what was that even about, her narrative arc in the film and her relationship to Billy Bob's character. Because again, it's one of those scenarios where two people are reading the scenario totally different than the other. So you wonder if that has something to do with who he is, the fact that he doesn't really express anything, that no one really knows how to read the guy. And everyone thinks that he's doing one thing and they're trying to go another way about it, you know, when really he's just sort of playing it straight the whole time. Love it. Great movie. Totally check it out. Most watchable movie of the four movies I did watch this month. I think the most entertaining.
Cool. Ended on a high note.
Yep.
So, what?
That was an ordeal.
No, that was efficient. We're getting good at this.
No, we're not, man. It's been six hours, man.
We covered a lot of territory. We are getting, we are snappy.
This is two episodes, right?
Yes. but no, we're getting so good at this that eventually the entire podcast will be done by a single Australian man.
Oh, perfect.
So, next up will be the official show. We'll talk about some new releases and some news and shit. And we'll start it all up with the Pokemon show. We're going to do a Pokemon show next month.
Okay. Hell yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, we got to do a pre-Pokemon show for the...
Yeah. For the Pokemon game.
For the Pokemon game.
On November the 18th.
Are we going to do like a wish list or what were we?
Oh, we'll probably talk about some of the new stuff they announced. They put out some new trailers and some new Pokemon and shit. We got stuff. Yeah. That's it. That's the end. Until next time.
So long.
See ya.